This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress, and I can't wait for you to hear the audio of my wife trying out her Sophie cave suit. Yeah. Sophie Reaptress makes cave suits in Philadelphia. She's been making clothes for a long time. She started making leggings, and when she started caving, she was looking for cave suits and didn't notice a whole lot to choose from. What's out there is okay, but she decided to make her own, and the way she makes them is the right way to make them. She makes them with 500 denier cordura, the real thick stuff. And even thicker where it counts, elbows, butts, knees, where you need some extra reinforcement. Lots of colors to choose from. My wife got the olive green, and she looks awfully cool in it. And she just tried it on the other night just for fun. The cave suits start from basic suits, and you can add things like pockets, inside pockets, knee pad pockets, and extra bat stencils if you want. Everything's made to order just for you. Look at the options you can select at SophieReaptress.com or find her on Instagram at SophieReaptress and get a real, real good cave suit for all your caving adventures. SophieReaptress.com for the caver on your holiday list. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. My name is Matt Pelser. I am a member of the Central Indiana Grotto and the National Speleological Society. What's a grotto? A grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. It's like a caving club, and we believe in organized caving because caving is not something that you want to go and just do because you've got to know how to do it right. It can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. Once you do, though, quite the opposite, and you'll make friends. So find your local grotto. I have a link in the description of this podcast to the NSS website and their map of local grottos. Click that, and you'll find one. Also, it was Giving Tuesday this past week. I gave to the Indiana Karst Conservancy and the NSS, and you could give to the NSS or your local grotto or your local Karst Conservancy as well. And, you know, just because Giving Tuesday has come and gone doesn't mean that it's too late for you to do so. So do that if you got some extra bucks. They could use your help. And, of course, the NSS are working on closing the gap for Vertical Bill's Tower. They could use your help there, so think about it. Just think about it. Well, the mystery's been solved. My cave suit has been found. I left it at Caver's Paradise on Sarah weekend back in May. And it was found, and nobody knew whose it was, and it was then auctioned off at Tag Fall Cave-In. I know who has it. I've been in contact with them, and you know, they paid good money, so I'm not going to demand that it be sent back to me. And besides, I like my Sophie suit, so you can keep that meander. Glad the money went to a good cause. It was my own mistake. So the cave suit has been found. Thank you to everyone who helped me find it. And now we can close the book on that. This month, we're talking to Jessica Jernigan. She has been caving for just over a couple of years now, but she's been doing an awful lot. And she is a great communicator. She's good at communicating the why, which so many of us think about in our early years of caving. Like, why do we do this? If you do this for a long enough time, the why kind of escapes you. The why is just because you have to. So she's still able to communicate that, and in a great way. I really, really loved talking to Jessica. And what's kind of funny about this talk is my office at my house is in the basement, and it's right below our bathroom. I talked to Jessica like back in February. This has been several months in the works, and we were remodeling our bathroom at the time, and my father-in-law was upstairs sawing and hammering and things like that. So you might hear some of that in the talk, but our bathroom is it's great now. But it was still in shambles when we did this interview, so that's what's going on. So let's do it. Oh, by the way, you can follow Jess Jernigan on Instagram at @TheJessJernigan. She posts a lot of caving stuff. I'm on Instagram at Matt Pelser Radio, and, you know, just in case you want to connect that way. All right, here's me and Jess Jernigan.
I still haven't gone to the grocery store after being away for almost 3 weeks. And so I scrounged, I think I had one banana from the road trip and some granola and peanut butter. And just I was basically still eating out of the cooler that's been in the back of my CRV for my whole little Texas adventure that I just concluded.
How brown was that banana?
Oh, I picked it up at a gas station. It was a nice fresh gas station banana from my last leg of my road trip.
the old 2 for $1 gas station banana, huh?
Exactly.
I can't tell you how many times, and I sound like such an idiot over this, but I can't tell you how many times I've turned down that deal. Like, I'll go to a gas station before work sometimes and pick up one banana, and they're like, you know, it's 2 for $1. And I'm just like, no, I just want the one. I'm just like, why don't I just get two? Why don't I just, I mean, better than the little taquito I'm getting in addition to the banana. Just eat two bananas instead.
It's not that much of a commitment, you know? It's like a little extra potassium.
I know. It's delicious. I don't know. It's, you know, it's the umami. My body and my mouth crave the umami.
There you go.
Jessica, welcome, and thank you for coming on the Caving Podcast. You came highly recommended from Fenn Spencer, and
I couldn't be more thrilled to be here, and was so flattered to be recommended by Fenn. He was a fast friend and kind of a friend mentor. I have many of those in this community, I feel like.
Well, and he is one to many, as I understand it, and that's wonderful.
Isn't that, and I think something that seems so unique about him, and I'm kind of curious if you can corroborate this. I know, you know, you're so familiar with a broad swath of the community. How many other cavers are nurturing 4 generations of cavers simultaneously?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Because let's think this through. We've got, Fenn has Squish, his granddaughter.
Yeah.
He's got, you know, my generation. You know, I'm in my early 30s. He's got his own contemporaries. And then he's got folks like Spider, that Neversink venture, you know, just this like elder community. I mean, 4 generations he is nurturing. Like, what a feat. He's just such an incredible person.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said about somebody in the community, or really in any aspect of life, that just lifts up everyone around them, and just that's what they want to do. You know what I mean? They just want to be the tide that raises all boats. That's admirable.
So admirable. Yes. And I see that thread kind of stitched through the caving community and manifesting in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of generosity and a high tolerance for novices. I think that's something I've appreciated so much, especially because I've only been at this for 17 months. I did the math on my cave log and figured out exactly how long I've been at it, which is not very long, but to be able to make friends with people who whose caving careers are older than my permanent teeth. Literally got friends who've been at it for a long time, you know, since they were children. And it's just so great to be able to learn from people who would deign to hang out with someone who's so new to this whole enterprise.
Course, none of this is any disrespect to the project cavers who are a little more exclusive, because they need that. In order to accomplish what they need to accomplish, they need to have the people with the experience around them. But yeah, there is that special group of people who will take the newbies, who will be patient with them, who will, you know, because everyone needs that in order to get to that level to then work with the serious project cavers.
Absolutely. And I know I've been so uniquely fortunate, I think, to fall in with the folks that I've fallen in with. And to be able to, I think, build the right skills early and kind of start, I feel like I've been laying the foundation of really, you know, good safety practices and being conscientious. And as I've kind of grown and moved throughout the community, I could imagine if I'd gotten in and not had that guidance, I either wouldn't have stuck around in the community or I could have hurt myself real fast.
There you go. There it is. I mean, that's why, among all the reasons why it is so important. Okay, so you just got back from Texas. What'd you do there? Can you tell me?
Yes, I can. So what drew me out there initially was getting my level 2 certification with NCRC, National Cave Rescue Commission.
Nice.
I had such a blast in Virginia at the national seminar last July that I just couldn't wait to register and go ahead and jump on and take level 2. And I just had an absolute ball. I lived in Austin, Texas for many years. I'm now based in TAG, but so after NCRC concluded, I stuck around in Austin for a little bit, and actually got to go and rappel off some cliffs in the Greenbelt and kind of experience Austin in a different way. But yeah, NCRC was just an absolute joy. I could speak volumes about it.
What is the motivation for your involvement in the rescue world in NCRC? I feel like I get different answers for this all the time. There are some people who really are sort of it seems macabre, but to say rescue junkies, you know, and it's not about the rescues. It's not about being there for the drama. It's about being helpful, you know. But then again, there are some people who go deep into NCRC just for that sort of practical experience to make themselves a better caver. Where on the spectrum are you as far as you wanting to be involved with NCRC?
You know, I'm finding myself gravitating towards the rescue side of things, having initially gotten interested in NCRC from that just a caver perspective. I was still a relatively new caver when one of my kind of close friends in the community mentioned that a slot in level one had opened up because someone had canceled their registration, and he looked at me and said, you should totally apply. And I don't have rescue experience. I don't have agency experience. You know, I work a tech job. But I did realize that if I was going to really lean into caving, I wanted to understand the kind of the full scope of risk and really build my skills and reinforce skills in under, you know, different contexts. And it also just kind of sounded like a fun, challenging adventure.
It's definitely that, as you know.
Yes. Yes. So initially, I decided to go to NCRC and pursue level one to just become a better caver, to continue on this path of building the right skills and also to meet people and do some networking. I got involved in my grotto early, and just through diving into events and things, I liked how easy it was to just get acquainted with such a diverse group of people. And so seeing what this interesting, you know, caving rescue, caving agency Venn diagram that NCRC creates just sounded really compelling to me. But since being involved, I'm now an aspiring member of our local rescue team. It's something I'm sort of gearing up to engage in that application process and really actually apply the skills in that rescue context. And I think that kind of traces back to an experience that I had on my my third ever caving trip, in which our group encountered another group that had just called for rescue.
Interesting.
Which was really interesting. And
what happened?
So it was in Tumbling Rock, and this was actually the first Chattanooga grotto trip in 2 years. I mean, it was their first kind of post-COVID, you know, getting the gang back together.
Yeah.
And my first grotto trip ever. And so we had made it all the way back to Mount Olympus. We had a pretty big group, and so we were coming back out towards the entrance, and I'm hazy on exactly where it was, but I mean, we're pretty deep in the cave still, and we encounter this huddle of other cavers. One of them just on the bare rock, kind of, you know, just laying in an uncomfortable position. And before I knew it, our group had leapt into action because multiple members of our grotto and, you know, who were present on that particular trip are on the Chattanooga, the Hamilton County, you know, technical rescue team.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I think that really planted a seed in my mind, just being so impressed with how they took control of that situation, because suddenly it was, okay, you head towards the entrance to alert other cavers to get out of the way of an evacuation that's going to have to proceed here shortly, and intercept rescue and let them know that we've identified the patient and, you know, we have a medic on site who's going to, you know, begin to sort of assess, you know, what's going on. So boom, he leaves. And then we did have, you know, a couple of medical professionals who go and start looking after this guy who had dislocated his shoulder.
Mm.
Which is apparently can be very serious.
Yeah.
For circulation reasons, things. still, I don't have a lot of medical training, but I know it was a very serious thing. He's laying on the cold rock. So another member of our group comes up to us and says, "All right, guys, give me all your extra layers and all the extra water and snacks in your pack if you have anything to spare." And so he just kind of takes this big, you know, load of all our extra Under Armour. And then we were sort of reassembled into a smaller group, you know, those of us that couldn't really contribute helping this guy out. And so we decided to get out of the way and sort of move out of the cave. And so by the time we exited the cave, there were trucks rolling in. There's a guy walking by with these huge spools of comm wire. And I ended up leaving the scene. I didn't stick around, but I believe it took them 7 hours to get this guy out of the cave, just based on where he was. And so that was really eye-opening for me, of course, from a multitude of reasons, right?
Yeah.
You know, took my friends and I, you know, a couple hours to kind of bebop all the way back to the Christmas tree and to Mount Olympus, and then to take 7 hours to get this guy back out, you know, what took us, you know, so relatively little effort. And so that was a pretty seminal experience for me and was really, really inspiring in a lot of ways. And so the thought of being able to leap into action and help out in a situation like that is become too intoxicating for me.
To see people leap into action like that. I mean, I've seen it just in a sort of a drill situation, and it's pretty cool even in that situation, but to actually be in a scenario where someone really does need help and it's not just someone pretending. I mean, I've not been there myself, but I'm sure that was really, really something that you'll never forget. And obviously something that's leading you down this path. Have you encountered any situations like that yourself since then?
Fortunately, no. I've been really uniquely fortunate in my short caving career as yet. I've had a couple of situations where I've been a little unnerved, and I can think of one situation that was. It was a few months after I got my level one certification. It was prior to going out to level two, when if someone had twisted an ankle or if there had been an extenuating circumstance and we'd gotten stuck in the cave for longer than we expected, things could have gone really south really quickly, because it was a sort of a wet multi-drop trip where we're, I believe there were five rappels of differing lengths, not a pull down trip. We sort of went, you know, down to the base of that last drop and then, you know, climbed the ropes that we rigged to get back up. And man, it was cold. It was really cold. Trip took a little longer than expected. So we're running a little low on calories. And so you get to that point where you know your fingers are not as nimble when you're rigging your ascension device, and I think experiences like that. Had I not been to NCRC, I would not have been as kind of alarmed by that circumstance. But now I'm a much more. I wouldn't say that I'm always thinking of the worst case scenario, but I'm certainly never planning for the best.
Mindful.
I always keep an extra layer in my pack and some extra water. Not for me. I pack enough to be able to give away to someone who might need it more. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that lingers. So fortunate to say I haven't had any other negative experiences or nothing to befall me personally.
I want to come back to rescue and NCRC as needed. But I feel like we've kind of established where you are as far as like a level of a caver. And we've kind of hinted at your level of experience as far as time, but you've packed an awful lot in what, a year and a half of caving?
About a year and a half, yes. I've done about 40 caves over the course of about 36 trips. So I've tripled up a few times.
I mean, obviously, first cave is something that I'm interested in, but was the first trip where you kind of got bit by the bug?
Yes. Oh, irrevocably.
Right off the bat.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Caving found me at the absolute right time. I was sort of freshly arrived in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I'd moved here from Austin, Texas. And so I was kind of primed to expand horizons and try new things. And I had literally, I was actually out just a couple hours away from having completed my first whitewater rafting trip ever. And I was hanging out with the friend that invited me, and we were just about to part ways, and he got a text message, and he looked up and he said, "You want to go caving tomorrow?" And I said, "Sure, what's that?" And just, I feel like this is how it begins for so many of us.
Yeah.
He said, "Grab some clothes you don't mind ruining, some Walmart knee pads, and meet at this Dollar General parking lot in rural Alabama this time tomorrow."
That sounds a little contrived when you put it that way.
Right. And at the time, it felt like a perfectly normal thing to do. To go and meet this person who he was, you know, kind of a new friend. So I wouldn't say an acquaintance, but someone I didn't know super well. And then I ended up meeting four of his friends from Birmingham. And we went to Kenmare Cave over in Alabama. Yep, we did a through trip that I can't remember exactly how long we were underground, but I think it was upwards of like 6 hours or so underground, and so car to car. I mean, it was an all day affair with the hike and everything. But I show up and I meet the crew, and they say, "Well, you overpacked, so throw a couple granola bars and water bottles in this what looked like a big black whoopee cushion." I learned later was a Swago. I now have one of my own, of course, and I've had breakfast with Scott at NCRC.
Oh, nice!
A couple times, but we hike up to the cave entrance, and I remember we were in the middle of a conversation about something mundane, and I'm second in line. The trip leader drops to his belly mid-sentence and just starts army crawling into the mud, into this pitch black darkness. And I had this moment of realization that I was about to do something that I had no frame of reference for. And I had never army crawled into into the black darkness before. And I thought, well, I sure don't want him to get so far ahead I can't find him. And I don't want to hold up these nice people behind me. And I don't want to have to wait in the woods for who knows how many hours if I'm too scared to go in here. So I guess I better drop down and start army crawling. And that was the first lesson that I continue to learn, or like the first instance of a lesson that I learn over and over in caving, which is that I really don't have a great conception of my own fears. And caving is a lesson in all the things that I'm not really as afraid of as I think initially. And that has been such a fun and enticing part of the whole activity, is when I come to the top of a really deep pit. You know, I would have told you a year ago I was afraid of heights, but now when I'm, you know, descending down, you know, a couple hundred feet into Valhalla or something, I have this feeling of calm serenity, you know, that's unmatched by anything else.
Can I just say real fast that all of that is a great illustration of just caving in general, and especially a good representation of first time caving for someone for whom has really gotten into it. That's really good. I applaud your word choices there. So thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. And you know what? I'm so glad that my first trip was such a monster of a trip, because it had a little bit of everything. It had pancake crawls. There was one pancake crawl where I had one leg dangling in this 60-foot crevice. There was a moment where we were chimneying up this little passage that probably should have had a hand line, but our strategy was to just like brace a foot on the shoulder of the person below you and then just kind of shimmy the rest of the way up. And I think at every turn, there was just something interesting to observe, something beautiful to look at. There were a couple folks on the trip were really knowledgeable in geology, and so they're sort of rattling off all these interesting facts and, you know, reciting the Latin names of all the little squirmy critters in the pools. And so it was a study in all the just the multitude of things that caving has to offer, with just the adventure and the science and the history and just the physical exertion of it. And so, I mean, we tied a nice little bow on the whole day with like a big, delicious meal at a Mexican restaurant well after dark. And I've never been so satisfied and so exhausted in my life.
Best meal of your life.
Yes, exactly. And then from there, I was just so hungry for it that I looked around every corner for my next cave trip. And then I was able to line them up. And I've managed to go caving almost every single month since then. And even when I skip a month, I'll be sure to commit multiple weekends in a single month.
Make up for it.
To catch up. Yes, exactly.
Wow. Okay. So that one, and then how soon after was the next trip? And I mean, that a 6-hour trip is pretty big for your first time. What came next?
Yeah, so next I found out that a friend I had already made in a totally different context in Chattanooga was an avid caver. She got her start in the Midwest, but was working at a nature preserve where I was volunteering on the weekends, you know, just in this little plant nursery. And I told her about this wild caving thing that I'd just tried, and her eyes lit up like a Christmas tree. And turned out she was surveying a cave just north of town up in Hickson, Tennessee. So that was about 2 weeks later, a little over 2 weeks later, she took me to Levi Cave, which is her little baby. And it was super fun. I went with her and her partner, who's a dear friend, and then another friend of theirs from Alabama. I think he's from the Birmingham Grotto as well. And it was, I think, a 3-hour trip or so. Got our start in the afternoon. Super adventurous, totally different morphology. It was a super muddy cave, all horizontal. Got to see a bunch of bats and some tons of salamanders. You know, it was a bit heavier on the bio inventory side. And so that was a super fun experience.
So was that like survey? Was that, I mean, did you have work to do in there, or were you just kind of checking the place out?
Just playing around. Yeah.
Nice.
It was fun. I would love to give survey a try and really devote some time to learning what that's all about at some point. It was fun going with someone who was actively mapping a cave, because not only did my friend have this intimate knowledge of all the, you know, cool formations and which way to go, which way not to go. But, you know, we came to one point and she goes, "Hey, that's Virgin Passage right there. You want to peep your head in there and check out that lead?" And I think she knew it was just sort of a quick little, like a small little room, you know, but to just be the first person to kind of clamber up in one area in who knows how long was, that was just exhilarating, its own fun little thrill.
That's a whole other rabbit hole. I mean, especially for people who do it all the time, you know. Do you feel yourself getting to that point soon enough?
To want to pursue survey?
Project caving, yeah.
Expedition project caving? I believe so. I know that at this point, I want to reinforce a lot of the skills that I've already built, because I feel like I have been drinking through a fire hose almost, which is the inundation of information and knowledge and experience that I've had so far, that I kind of want to solidify some of skills before I start adding new. But I will say that project caving survey is my next chapter that I really want to dig into.
I really though appreciate that perspective, in that you want to get the experience. And I mean, you're starting strong is what it comes down to. You know, you're starting strong and you're focusing on something, and eventually you'll diversify your experience. But let's just do this, as much of this, whatever this is, as we can right now.
Exactly. And I think one of the key things that I learned at NCRC, particularly in Texas during the big ice storm that swept through and kept us company the whole time we were camping out there.
Oh, gosh.
Was that, you know, do you really know a skill if you can't perform it under extreme circumstances, under extenuating circumstances, when you're really tired, you're really hungry, when you're really cold, when there's a lot of distraction going around? And that was something I learned about myself, was I was not as prepared as I thought, because I had been practicing a lot of skills under optimal conditions. I have a little hank of rope that's rigged to a pull-up bar in my kitchen doorway, because I live in an apartment. I don't have a tree or anything that I can, you know, practice rope skills from. So I'm practicing my changeovers, you know, on this nice little rope in the air conditioning in my apartment, right?
Right on. You're doing it. I mean, it's better than most people can say, you know?
That's true. But now I'm at this point where I want to be able to do a changeover blindfolded, because what happens if my, you know, my light falls off my helmet or something, and I'm, yeah, you know, really, really stranded. So that's kind of my focus now, is learning the skills under all circumstances, and especially, you know, if things get dicey.
Yeah, indeed. Speaking of vertical, that's another step, you know, and most of the time when I talk to somebody who's been caving a long time, they, I mean, maybe with the exception of tag cavers, and you're a tag caver, they didn't get into vertical within, you know, the first year of getting into caving. You know, they pretty much stick to horizontal for a while, and then vertical is then the next thing. But down in tag, you kind of have to do vertical. And so, I don't know, I guess I'm just curious when that part came in.
Yeah, so that came in just a couple of months into my caving career. I made friends, I had the great fortune to make friends with some folks that have been caving since they were in college, I mean, kind of over a decade, and had, and then were a part of, you know, involved in CRC. And so they were adamant about safety and having the right kit, knowing how to use it. And so if I got my start in September 2021, it was in December of that year that I did my first foray into vertical. Started in a tree in a friend's backyard.
As it always does.
And borrowed a kit. And I can still remember the first couple of times I tried to rig the rope into the micro rack. I did it backwards and upside down, and it was just so mystifying. But after just a couple hours practice, I finally had it down, and we went to a cave on Fox Mountain called Rusty's. I forget exactly. I think the drop is less than 50 feet with the friends that had basically just gotten me trained up in the tree earlier that afternoon. And it was a great first start. Just kind of that quick little, I think it's maybe 45, 50 feet down. And then it was a mostly horizontal trip from there. But my second vertical cave was Cemetery Pit, which is, I believe, 152 feet. So a bit of a jump from like 45 up to 152.
I mean, so 45 feet, I mean, a lip is a lip, right? Getting over the lip, no matter how high up you are, is mm-hmm. on your first drop is a bit of a what is the word I'm trying to look for? It's
a little daunting.
It is daunting. There you go. Daunting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It was daunting. I think two factors made that first drop really doable. One was that it's a modest little pit. So you're not coming up to this big gaping, you know, with sunbeams and waterfalls, you know, all this drama, like you'd see at some of the other really grandiose tag, pits. So it's just this, you know, it's a little squeezy. It's a little, you know, it's a little confined. It's just a much more, muted, easily accessible kind of first drop. But also I had so much to focus on, for example, the safety check. I remember the friends that I was with were kind of asking me if I had any questions. You know, they're saying, you know, just want to make sure you know what the next step is. Like, hey, did you check to make sure that, you know, this is in place? And so kind of going over the inventory of safety measures and things was also, it gave me enough to focus on that before I knew it, I was getting off rope at the bottom.
So that's a learning experience. But then you do a real tag drop. Having done the first one, did it make the second one easier, where the fall was an awful lot longer?
I, for whatever reason, that bigger, longer drop was entirely manageable. I think, yes. And I wonder about this all the time, why this was. And I do think that it had to do with how much trust I had in the people I was with and how they were able to set my expectations for what was going on. I remember this was Cemetery Pit, kind of the first big drop. And I'm watching my friend rig our rope, and he's talking through why he's using these bolts instead of those over there. And then saying, you know, he coaches me, briefs me on, you know, what to expect on the drop. It's like, hey, you're going to go down part of the way. There's going to be a lip. And then you just kind of back over that next little ledge and come on down. Super straightforward. And I remember just easing down the rope. I was going super slow, just kind of slowly spinning, kind of taking it all in. And
that's like my favorite. I love just, you know, taking my time on the way down.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what proceeded was just a super adventurous, sporty trip where we just got to see so many different portions of the cave and so many just fun little experiences. It was just all worth it. I think by the time we got back to the base of the rope, ready to leave, that was when I realized how you got to be conservative with your energy. If you have too much fun out in the cave, that climb back up can be kind of arduous. But no harm, no foul.
So this is a weird question to ask because I feel like it's kind of a spectrum, and you know, it's not just black and white, but. Like I know people who like to just bounce pits, and then I know people who don't really want to do vertical unless there's cave down there. What camp are you in if you want to pick one?
At this point, I really want to improve my stamina and improve my technique on rope so that I'm moving more efficiently. And so I'm in a mode now where I like to, I'll bounce the same pit multiple times if I'm there kind of with friends. That's when I went to Never Sink for the first time, I did that just for no reason other than to just try to do it more efficiently, do it faster the next time.
And that's a beautiful place to do that. I mean, you really couldn't ask for much better
Absolutely.
Environment.
Absolutely. I love that place. We went in this, I really want to catch it at every season. I've seen it in a couple seasons now, but yeah, it's such a beautiful, beautiful cave.
What other classics have you been to? And would you say you frequent any of those classics down there, the sort of SCCI properties?
I have made multiple trips to Stevens Gap. It never gets old. I feel like
I have never been.
Oh man.
Still never been. I got to come down. Like what I want to do this year is I want to just pick a long weekend and come down and do as many of those classics as I can. And I keep saying I'm trying to set that up, but I'm really not. Like I've got a few friends down there who would happily do it. I just need to pick a daggone date on the calendar. That sounds awesome.
Absolutely. I mean, gosh, I can't imagine how many friends you've got down here. Just if you count fans of the of the podcast as well, folks that would be so grateful to take you out and show you a good time around
that. That might be one of the biggest reasons that I do the podcast is so I can kind of always have a standing invitation to come and do something, you know?
That's great. Yes. I will say there are so many lovely classics. I know one cave that I can't wait to go back to is Snail Shell. Are you familiar with this one?
Snail Shell's been talked about on the podcast. Yeah. Amazing place. Yes.
Pro tip, inflatable stand-up paddleboard is the way to do it.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah? Wait. Stand up or lay down? Like, what are you talking about?
Oh, so you can, a lot of folks, when they go to Snail Shell, they'll take like a pool float or just a life preserver or just try to doggy paddle on their Swago. But, you know, the whole cave, essentially, up until you get right back to a little crawl, is you're just basically floating on this little underground river, essentially. It's beautiful. But the hike down into the sink is a pretty steep one. And then once you get in, you want something kind of rugged enough to sort of bounce off the rocks and the walls that, you know, it won't be punctured. And so I found that inflatable stand-up paddleboard was easy to hike in, pump it right up at the entrance. And then I was able to stand up and float through, just kind of paddle through the cave. I have some cool pictures that I can share with you.
Oh yeah, there we go. Okay. All right. So the reason I asked about, you know, laying down is because I'm not been there, but I do know how caves tend to be, and oftentimes you don't have room to stand up. But it looks like you've got some room to stand up there.
That's right. Yeah, the ceilings were super, super high, and so I'm not sure exactly how deep the water was, but we're essentially just floating through this beautiful, very linear passage with these steep walls and formations going up on either side.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I have seen photos of this entrance. That's just kind of a dramatic sink, and then this really cool big entrance. I mean, Snail Shell, as I understand it, has been kind of a big project for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. You know, there's been dives that have happened there. And so when I think of project caving and that, I think of long trips and things like that. And I know you yourself are not a project caver yet, but some of my favorite trips have been the longest trips. What's the longest you've spent underground?
Gosh, I think the longest time I've spent underground was during the mock rescue for my level one NCRC.
Okay.
That was an all-day affair. And if you'd asked me what I wanted to spend my time on during that rescue, I would have written down exactly what ended up happening to a T. I ended up doing exactly what I wanted to do, which was being on the communications task force.
Ah.
Which was something that I found fascinating, something for a variety of reasons, not least of all being that I was one of the first people in the cave and literally one of the last people out after the whole mock rescue operation had concluded. So I got to see initially to set up the comm lines and start the first comm station. And once you get on the line, then you start to experience the development of the whole narrative of the rescue as things are being discovered. That mock rescue scenario had a little element of mystery to it. The report was that there were some vehicles sort of left parked at a cave entrance, you know, for a couple of days. And so we're not sure how many cavers are in there, and we're not sure exactly where they came from. And so there was a bit of like crime scene forensics almost to say,
kind
to
of try exciting.
And discern how many patients to even look for initially. And so I got to spend my time at that comm station and sort of helping to triage, you know, messages up to the surface and to the underground command structure as it started to develop. And then our comm station leapfrogged to essentially the back of the cave at the very last rescue of the last patient that had been found. And so after getting to kind of listen in and get that bird's eye view of sort of the whole rescue developing as the hours passed. Then at the very end, as the last evacuation was occurring, our comm station, it was a level two student and myself, it was actually Seth Parker, who you interviewed on this podcast.
Yeah.
As well.
Oh man, I love talking to Seth.
He was great. Yes. We ended up actually following the last evacuation out, which was this just dramatic scene of, you know, one of our instructors in a litter and all the evacuation team and this rigging that they'd set up to kind of pull the litter over obstacles. And so we're reporting the status of the evacuation as we're in transit, spooling up comm wire. It was sort of a comedy of errors as Seth and I were literally connected by a couple feet of comm wire as he was talking on the phone and I was holding the spool and spooling it up as we traveled through the cave following that last evacuation team. And so I think all told, I think starting around 9 a.m. to about 4 p.m., So that was a good full day underground.
Yeah, absolutely. I ran Calm on the one mock rescue I've done. It was just OCR. It was just the weekend thing. And yeah, I loved it. I mean, because it was a cave I was very familiar with, which was nice, but I don't think I've ever moved that quickly through that part of the cave as I did when I was, you know, unspooling that comm line. Because you, even though it's a mock rescue, you really feel this sense of urgency that you've got this task to perform. You don't necessarily want to be the first one to find whoever, whatever, but you think, you know, it would be nice if, you know, we get to this person, we find this person fast and, you know, get a good grade. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was exciting running comm line.
I thought so too. And it's surprisingly challenging to keep up with the development of information and the movement of information. And you're right. You're right about that sense of urgency. I found that to be such a valuable part of the experience too, is it puts you in a position where you have to actively remind yourself to slow down and to discern and to kind of think about what the next step should be.
What's interesting, I think, about rescue, and I'm, you know, not a rescue person. I've done the one OCR, but I think that from my perspective, which is an outsider's perspective, to be sure, that the thing about rescue that I think hooks people on rescue is probably the same thing that hooks me about caving in general, is I think it's the meditation of it. The fact that you have to accomplish this task, you have this one thing that you have to do. And for me, you know, it's caving, and that's moving through the cave, and you have to be aware of everything, and you can't have these distractions. You don't have the phone in your pocket doesn't work anyway. So that's not distracting you from the world. And so to me, it's like a meditation, but you add that level of a mission and that adds another layer to it. Do you find that to be the case too, as far as like what is hooking you to it?
Oh, absolutely. I do. I think that Ann Baker put this so succinctly in her an article that she wrote on Appalachian Trail Thru Hikers.
A favorite subject of mine. I'll have to check that out.
Oh, yes, yeah. Absolutely. So you'll love this. This has come to really help me to frame my fixation on caving and on the now the rescue side of things as well. So Ann Baker thru hiked the Appalachian Trail and just became possessed by this question of why people do that to themselves. And so she's
I've asked the same question after many a cave trip, you know, the 2 days after where you're just dying of soreness.
Exactly. And so she set out on this quest to survey other thru hikers, and she's a psychologist. And so she kind of put together this sort of compiled her research and synthesized it and came up with this acronym that explains why folks would subject themselves to, you know, a 2,000 mile, you know, trek, you know, through the wilderness. And I think this is so relevant to caving. And the acronym is SPACE, and the S stands for simplicity, which I think gets to what you just mentioned about sort of the narrowing of focus. When you're in a cave, you can only really be concerned about whatever your headlamp is illuminating at that moment. You're more concerned about hunger and thirst and cold than you are in everyday life. Just the script for living becomes so much more concise and simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
And the P in SPACE stands for purpose. You have this objective. We're going to, if you're just on a caving trip, we're trying to get back to that room or that speleothem, or, you know, we're trying to get back to that drop and in a rescue, of course, you're trying to, you know, act in the patient's best interest and, you know, orchestrate this operation. The A is adventure or adversity, potentially, which, you know, that's what it's all about.
In retrospect, adversity equals adventure. In the moment, it's not as fun. But, mm-hmm. you know, if you get through it and come out the other side, like you kind of crave that, the best parts of that anyway.
Yep. I read recently that the word adventure etymologically breaks down to that which must happen. And that's just what I tell people now. My adventures are just required.
Yeah, I just need, you know, to.
It's just what's supposed to happen. Let's see, getting back to you. So out of the acronym space, so the C is community, which is seminal to all things caving, right? This isn't a solo activity. You're utterly reliant on your group, and then in a rescue situation, of course, that network of individuals and groups and task forces is so paramount. And then the E is exertion or exercise. And so just that worn out feeling by the end of it. I think that I just love how those five concepts just sort of perfectly encapsulate the draw for me, at least.
Because it takes so much of you to make this happen. I mean, the physicality, yeah, but the mental exertion as well of caving. It just takes so much. You have to be fit in many different ways in order to do it. And I think that there was an interesting perspective that was shared on the podcast recently from Marion Akers regarding how she felt after her rescue, after the 40, you know, some hours that she spent underground waiting for the water to go down, and talked about the fact that she, you know, and I don't want to speak to her experience so much as, but to just sum it up, basically, she said that she was depressed afterward, even though she made it out fine and everything was okay. What it came down to was that so much became in that moment, in those moments, in that long duration, devoted to her survival, that when all of those brain chemicals were then used up, there was nothing left. And so I'm not equating a serious rescue to something like a through hike or something like that, but you are in a situation where, yeah, you've got to live with what's on your back, or when you're in a cave, you've got to live with what you bring with you. You've got to make it through. It's very physically exerting. And then what you're left with after a cave trip is not so much depression, but longing for the next one, because you need that experience again to kind of flood your brain with all of those chemicals. In a way, that's kind of what is sort of happening.
I think so. Well, and I think that caving, just by good luck or happenstance, replicates an ancient human experience.
Exactly.
That is harder and harder to get.
Exactly.
In modernity. I want to go carry heavy things through the wilderness with my friends, mm-hmm. And periodically eat snacks. I mean, humans did that for millennia, and now caving is kind of one of the few opportunities to replicate that experience. And I think there's a reason why our brains take to it, why those behaviors that constellation of experiences is so incentivized by our brains, because that small group, common purpose, some objective, a little bit of adventure, a little bit of physical exertion is, that's what makes us tick as humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we're jonesing for that in
that,
between trips, for sure.
That which must happen. Oh, man. I love that. I hope I never forget that. Jess, one thing that I am bad at is documenting my experiences. I can tell you what caves I've been to. I can tell you that I haven't been to a cave. You know what I mean? I can maybe, if I've been there only a few times, tell you how many times I've been to a cave and what areas I've been to. But I don't write any of it down. I feel like maybe I should. I understand that's something that you do.
Yes. Did I send you a link to my cave log?
Oh yeah, you do. It's like an Excel spreadsheet, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're doing it. You're doing the whole thing here. Wow. Okay.
I'm trying. Well, one thing that has been so striking to me about this community is that information doesn't flow in the caving community like it flows in other activities and other communities. You know, you can't Google, you know, an article to figure out where that entrance is and how long of a rope you need. You need to talk to somebody, or you need to find some buried trip report or some like esoteric little abstract. And I mean, that's where the SCCI resources, their website is just such a huge boon to the community, having information be accessible. But I've come to learn that I need to keep track of the things I've done and the small details, sometimes the smallest details of how to even get to the cave in the first place and what you see while you're there and what you want to come check out the next time, because a lot of these caves bear repeating is something that I'm really trying to get better about. And I wasn't as strong about documenting things kind of early in my career, but I've been, well, I have you to thank for inspiring me to get my log up to date as I was preparing for this conversation and sort of thinking things through. And I think in addition to just logging information about the caves themselves, being mindful of what updates I need to make to my gear, to my pack, you know, what is someone else using on this trip that I've never even thought to include in my pack? What kind of redundancies, can I do without when I'm packing, you know, lean for the next trip? And so I find that documenting those experiences is a great way to optimize myself as an individual, and but also hopefully create some value for the community and for other new cavers, because you know I won't be a new caver for much longer.
you're deep into it. You're gonna keep on going. You're gonna keep rocking. I love the detail here, and I do appreciate you sharing this with me. Like, I feel like I'm like looking into your caving life by reading through this. You write down in a pretty good amount of detail all the things that you learn on every trip. And I mean, I'm just picking out a few things here. Don't trust chert, you know, and just a number of these great things. I don't want to embarrass you by reading off anything you wouldn't want the rest of the world to know, but these are notes to yourself. Like, this is clearly an investment that you're making in yourself by, you know, documenting these things that you learn that you want to apply to the future trips that you're going to take. That's a great idea.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. It helped all of those little notes kind of spark these memories of stories and funny little experiences, and also just help me to remember and help me to retain and recall these things. I'm so impressed by the members of the community that just have that encyclopedic knowledge that can rattle these things off. And so I don't have that ability innately. So just writing things down is my way to solve that.
So when I first started thinking about getting into caving seriously, one of the reasons was, you know, at the time for me, personally, it was kind of a tough time. I was going through a divorce, and I was looking for a community, any community really to latch onto in some way, you know what I mean? Just to kind of, I needed friends, you know, I wanted to do something that was unique, and I was already kind of into caving. I was already a member of the Grotto. And so I hit it hard after that. And the community is really kind of what keeps me coming back. I mean, obviously the activity is great, but some of the coolest people that I've ever met, because I admire cavers, you know, and I admire what we do, has kept me coming back. And when it comes to that community for you, grottos and whatnot, I guess, what are your reflections on that?
Gosh, I'm so grateful for the degree to which the caving community reminds me of how much more I could be doing all the time. Have you ever met a more eccentric and driven and just industrious group of people
I am always amazed to hear, you know, from the particularly active members of my grotto and other grottos, like, oh yeah, last weekend we went here, and then the weekend before that we went here. And I'm like, man, I'm lucky if I get a trip in every couple months, you know. I can't believe you're doing it so often and so big every weekend, you know?
Absolutely. No, I have many friends who I'll just kind of get a flurry of text messages from them on Monday morning saying like, oh, hey, sorry, I was, you know, underground all weekend doing this and that. No, I really am. I got into caving, or I think gravitated to caving, out of a desire to find community. And so I find that very relatable, what you just said. And, you know, I think it's something I've noticed recently is that the caving community seems to draw a lot of veterans, military veterans. And I'm not a veteran myself. I'm very, very curious and very intrigued about the military and just that whole experience. And I had a conversation with an Army veteran who is a cave diver and an avid caver and member of a rescue team. And he was, I just asked him point blank, you know, why, what about, what do you like about caving? And he did draw these kind of through lines between his military experience by saying that, you know, when he got out of the military, he realized that, you know, the civilian world seemed to be devoid of people who were gritty and curious and slow to complain and interested in challenging themselves, interested in tinkering with things, and that he started to find those characteristics in the caving community.
Isn't and that interesting?
Really interesting.
Wow. Okay. I love that.
Yeah, I find that to be so instructive that caving would appeal to a group of people who are looking for close ties, looking for common purpose, and looking for just a, you know, a particular type of set of characteristics like that. I've been really trying to diversify my caving family and meet people that have from different backgrounds. And, you know, particularly in the wake of Marion Smith's passing, I was affected by that, not because I knew him, but because I missed an opportunity to meet him.
Right.
And that has really stuck with me. I remember at my very first tag, which I attended, I mean, just a couple of weeks after my very first caving trip, I was standing with, you know, one of my new friends, and they were pointing things out to me, pointing people out to me, saying like, oh, that's, you know, that's Andy. You should totally meet him. And that's where we're going to have the big bonfire. And, that guy by the fire is, that's Marion Smith. You know, he is, and they started enumerating his accolades. And I just remember making this little mental note, like, oh, I should go talk to him later. And, you know, that was 2021. And, unfortunately, even though I know people who know him and, or who knew him, I never got that chance to actually sit down with him and ask him questions. And so I'm trying to never make that mistake again. I'm trying to always sort of align myself with the most experienced caver in the room. I got all the time in the world to talk to the newbies, but we're running out of time to, you know, talk to some of these like pillars of the community who are just so knowledgeable.
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the things I want to do with this podcast too, is, you know, to reach out to more of the people who have been doing it for so long, whose oral history really needs to be heard by the broader caving community and not just those in their own circle. I hope that that happens. So, all right, Jessica, to wrap up here, what do you want to do next? What's coming? What's on your list? Not the list that you sent me, but on the list of things that are yet to come.
List of things that are yet to come. So I'm leaning into the rescue side of things. I want to continue building skills and want to, I'm inquiring about that application process. So hopefully I'll have some updates on that before too long. Mm-hmm. The way the math shakes down, I've averaged about 2 caves per month for my whole career, mm-hmm. which is a respectable, you know, it's a good steady pace, I think.
I'd say so, yeah.
And I really want to amp that up. I really want to, I want to see if I can get that average up to at least 3 and really start revisiting some favorites unabashedly, but also taking opportunities to check out the little small kind of off the beaten path little trips too, you know, not to turn my nose up at a small little pit. I actually learned, I dropped down a little 35 foot pit that was just a little afterthought. We weren't even, you know, planning on dropping it. And at the very bottom, found this giant, majestic 8-point buck skull.
Whoa.
Which you never know what you'll find at the bottom of the smallest, most little modest pit that's kind of lingering kind of next to your objective. So those are kind of the main things. I'm also, I'll go ahead and mention this. I'm starting a yoga teacher training program this month, actually. And
Yoga is very applicable in caving.
Incredibly applicable. And so that is something I am really thinking about over the course of the next 10 months. I'll be working on that certification. And yoga is something that I would like to find a way to incorporate into the community and see what I can bring back to try to add some value. So that is something that I'm thinking about. It hasn't quite taken shape yet, but I think it will over the course of the year.
No, I think you got it. I think you got it right there. That's a great idea. If you can inject some of that into the caving world, I think it would be appreciated, and it could certainly be something that I think would make a lot of people better cavers if they focused on that part of themselves. Great idea. Oh, on those lines of things coming, grotto leadership maybe in the future?
You know, I am the secretary of the Chattanooga Grotto.
You're already way ahead of me.
As of this month, yeah. We just had elections. And I do have a couple little projects that I've already pitched to try and bring some skill growth and a bit more cohesion to the Grotto. We see a lot of new faces, and then, you know, it's always a shame when that new face doesn't come back. And
yeah.
So I am, we'll kind of work this out with the other members of the leadership team, but I would like to try and put myself in a position of new member liaison or something to try and just help people to build those roots as easily as I was able to. Mm-hmm. I got super lucky with just meeting the right people at the right junctures and maybe just being just extroverted enough to, you know, elbow my way into the right conversations. I don't know. So I want to cultivate as inviting an environment as I experienced for, you know, those new faces that show up to the monthly meetings.
The first impression, those first handshakes can make a big impression on a new caver. It certainly did me when I showed up, and some of the big name cavers in my grotto were some of the first to say hi, welcome, and things like that. It's so important. So I appreciate that. Jessica, this was a great talk. Thank you so much. I can't wait to see what you end up doing more of in the future. And I hope it's not the last time that we talk either.
Ditto that. I absolutely can't wait to stay in touch and would love to speak again in the future. I'll keep you abreast of all the irons I have in the fire.
Right on.
And then once you make it down to TAG, please count me among your trip partners. I'd love to show you some of the classics down here.
All right, careful. I'm going to hold you to that.
You've got my log now. You know where I've been.
I know where you're going. All right. Thank you, Jessica.
All right. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you, Jess. Thank you so much. What a great talk. And next month, the beginning of 2024, kicks off with part one of a two-parter. An Indiana caver I have admired for a long, long time. He's currently heading up the exploration effort in Indiana's longest cave, Binkley. He is Rand Hazlett. And he came by the house and we sat and talked for hours. It was awesome. And we'll kick off 2024 with the first half of that nice long talk. We get into it, man. Rand Hazlett, next month. Thanks to our sponsors, Sophie Reaptress. Go to sophiereaptress.com. Maybe get a cave suit for the caver on your holiday shopping list. That'd be awfully nice. And, of course, you can support this podcast by supporting caving. Donate to your local Karst Conservancy or your grotto or the NSS. Or support our past sponsors. Swago, swagogear.com, gets you a nice pack. What'd she call it? The giant whoopee cushion? Also, El Spelio, now being sold by On Rope One. Or Organic Robot Designs in Greenfield, Indiana, t-shirt shop. If your grotto wants to do a t-shirt sale for fundraising, hit up Charlie. He's your guy. Search Organic Robot Designs. All right, man, that's it for 2023. Until then, I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Kill nothing but time.